17 years on the air, we thought it was high time to investigate a medium that we have not explored on this program before. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly segment devoted to the exploration of the visual arts. My co-host, Stephen DeLuque, and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Our guest today is Dennis Kehoe, an artist who lives in Los Osos, and as you will learn, explores many materials and ideas, but we are visiting with him today to discuss blacksmithing. It is kind of surprising that we haven't touched on this one before, but we haven't, and we are very glad to be able to rectify that situation. So without further ado, let's visit him at his studio in Los Osos. I'm out here on a nice windy day in Los Osos with Dennis Kehoe. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You are our first blacksmith.
Wow, what an honor, truly.
Yeah, I'm excited too. We're in your nice, compact little studio. Have you had this for a while?
I built this 2 years ago. It's an ongoing project. It's a glorified shed. It's 120 square feet. It's nice, though, nice and intimate. All the tools are really close. Don't have to reach too far to get them. It's been quite a project.
I have done a little studio building and remodeling myself. I certainly know that a lot of thought, where do I want this? What does the floor plan really need to be, whether it's 100 square feet or 1,000? It's always a challenge.
Yeah, and it's ever evolving, and it's nice that I've been able to work in it, and it's not complete because I know more now of where I want things and how I'm going to set up the tools and the placement of everything.
Okay, so as our first blacksmith, what sorts of things did you need to accommodate? Obviously a forge, so where'd you begin?
If you know how to weld and you're good with metal, you can build those. But the first big tool was the anvil. I looked for several months and I scored one on Craigslist. Really any chunk of steel would do, but I found a beautiful German anvil, pretty much brand new. Perfect size. It doesn't need to be too big, but you don't want it too small. That was a big starting point, was getting that anvil.
And you've got a sanding wheel here.
This I mainly use for reshaping tools. As you use them with the hot work, they'll deform, and it's nice to have a grinder right here that you can reshape them. And then also the chef knives that I make. This is where I do all the sanding and grinding on those.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about what you end up producing in this nice little compact area.
Yeah, so I've been just playing it off of what people want. I have a young family, so taking care of them is priority one. So for me right now, I am just kind of listening to what people want, and the chef knives are a popular one. I love making them. I've done several ornamental architectural type features. I did a large gazebo about a year ago. That was really fun. Learned a lot. A couple awnings. Tools. I've been making tons of tools, mainly for myself, and that's really where I started, making tongs, chisels, punches, those types of tools. There's a lot of wonderful contemporary blacksmithing going on out there. You know, a lot of people think of the traditional ironwork and the scrolls and the leaves and the flowers and that type of stuff, but there's a lot of beautiful contemporary work I hope to get to, more gates and railings and big stuff like that.
Let's see, it would have been in the 70s. I went to a craft school up in Naples, New York, and they had a large blacksmithing program. As a silversmith, it was a very interesting introduction because I took the class, and I'm hammering away, and at that time it just seemed so crude in comparison to what I do.
I could see that. This would be a nightmare for a silversmith, all the rust and all the dirt and the coal. But I absolutely love it. I love that part of it. I do love the filing and the finish work, too, and I do get to do a lot of that. That's really nice, too. And I'm interested in trying some of the silversmithing, more coppersmithing.
We can get you hammering on a different kind of scale.
Yeah, yeah, that would be great. Yeah, a different kind of scale, exactly.
So how did you get into this?
This is something I sought out, and I originally wanted to incorporate it with the sculpture work I was doing at the time. I took a class down at Allen Hancock College with Hans Deuce. He's a blacksmith down in Buellton, and it was a Friday evening class. So I think there was only 8 classes, and I got through half of them. It was really hard to get down there on a Friday evening. And I mean, I would have loved to have continued, but it just didn't make sense for me at the time. And I kind of thought to myself, you know, this is something I can just start doing and pick up. And YouTube, tons of YouTube, tons of videos, tons of books, and really just trying it and failing forward and going on with it. And I've also attended California Blacksmith Association conferences every spring. They have a wonderful conference. People from all over the state and all over the Western United States really come together and do workshops and just get together and hang out. And I've learned a lot just by watching these guys work and then coming back to my studio and trying it and failing and figuring it out. And you kind of hit these marks, these points where everything comes together. You know, mm-hmm. You're fighting, and then, you know, maybe it's muscle memory, hand-eye coordination, something starts to click. And, you know, those moments are great. Kind of keeps you going.
Absolutely. I know that blacksmithing, and I tend to equate it with the rise in the price of gold and then silver, and people started looking to other materials kind of late 70s, early 80s, when that started to really take off.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun getting together with other smiths because it can be a wonderful kind of group activity and teamwork. You know, you can use a striker, so someone will swing the sledge while you're holding other tools that will, you know, form the metal. Drink beers and have the fire going and tell stories and do work. It's an absolute joy to work in that way.
And you mentioned sculpture, so how early in your life did you start creating?
Oh, as early as I can remember. Clay, Play-Doh, mud.
All of the essentials.
All those beginning base materials. But it wasn't until I moved up to San Luis Obispo and I took a bronze casting class with Margaret Coroshelli, and that must be some 18 years ago now. Through meeting Margaret, I got the pleasure of working with her husband, Bozzo, as an apprentice as a stone sculptor for about a year and a half. Doing the bronze for several years, it just kind of, the materials, the cost, I kind of wanted to search something else out and something more direct. You know, the stone sculpture was really direct, and I loved that. And I knew I liked working directly and with my hands. And the bronze casting is real indirect. You're working with clay, then wax, then molds, and you eventually get what you want, you know, your piece into bronze, but there's all these steps in between that aren't working directly with the material. So I thought blacksmithing and metalwork. By that point, had learned how to weld and do some metal forming and shaping, and it was frustrating and crude, and I wanted to learn more. As I got started, I kind of remembered as a kid, like, thinking about, yeah, blacksmithing looks pretty cool. Maybe someday I'll do that. And I, you know, I didn't really know what that meant or what was involved. You know, I knew there was fire and a hammer and a big, you know, anvil, but I didn't really know.
Were you seeing it in person or more in film, things like that?
It had to have been film and images. You know, books at my grandma's house and TV shows. Yeah, some guy wailing away making a sword or something like that. Whoa, that's pretty cool. Once I tried it, it just really took over. I just fell in love with the craft. It's just an amazing craft.
You're speaking really well to what Stephen and I have discovered a lot as we've been talking with people over these years, is, you know, what it is to discover finally in your search a material that seems to work.
Yeah.
That gets you able to do whatever it is you want to do.
Yeah, and I enjoy the indirect processes as well, but this speaks to me, you know, much more clear. I also enjoy doing printmaking, which is really indirect, you know, still.
And backwards.
And backwards, yeah. But you know what I like about that is just the mental kind of tweak and challenge there is a lot of fun. And the blacksmithing is like that too. You know, you have an end idea or shape, and what you do 3 steps before is going to determine what it ends up being 5 steps down the way. So really got to think these things through. You got to fail. You got to figure out those steps as you go. It takes time. It takes a lot of time.
Well, I think metal in general, as I've said many times, we don't get to just roll it up like a ball of clay and start over. So there has to be a little bit of willingness to plan.
Exactly. Yeah. And it took me a while to figure that out. Also, I've done a lot of painting, and that's nice where you can just, throw the paint on there. But with the metal, having a plan every day coming into the forge, into the shop, is just absolute necessary.
Do you need to plan to the very end, or do you have a plan that's a rough sketch in your head?
These days I'm working really hard to have it completely planned. Full-scale drawings, measurements. I'm trying to do this, as a business and, take care of my family. So it's really important that I'm efficient with my time. And the more I can plan, it just goes so much better.
Well, when working with clients, then you're also needing to get their buy-in to what you're doing. And if it is functionally needing to fit someplace or serve some specific purpose, then obviously that has to be taken into account.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Working with clients, I've learned a lot. All the artwork I did before this was on my own terms and my own ideas. And so this has been really challenging and good for me to work with clients, develop ideas, and see them through to the end.
If you have just joined us, you are listening to Ears on Art, produced at the studios of KCBX in San Luis Obispo, California. Co-host Krissa Hewitt continues her conversation with artist and blacksmith Dennis Keough, where he discusses the process of working with clients on commissioned works.
Talk through that process a little bit. Somebody comes to you and?
And we meet. I get an idea of what they want. I look at the space it's going to fit, because that's really important. Kind of check out their style as well. See what they have around the house. Different styles, if they have ironwork already, what kind of styles are there. And then I do sketches. I like to do 2 or 3 sketches as a base and then take it back to them and see if I'm going in the right direction and refine it from there. And then once we do have a final design, like I said, I draw it out full scale, take measurements. You're starting with one long piece of bar stock, and you got to bend it and twist it and forge it into that shape. So you need to know how much to even start with. You got to be open to the process, and things are going to change. It's not going to come out exact. But I haven't had a client question, that it didn't come out right. It always comes out right in the end. And I always have the door open if they want to come in and see the work being made and see where it's being made. It's been really nice working with people in that way.
Sometimes people don't want to work with clients because they don't want to have too much dictation of what's going on. So is there a mental hurdle that you have with that, or has that been pretty straightforward?
Pretty straightforward. Like I said, I have a family to take care of. What a gift to be able to do that, building things with my own hands in my own shop at my own house. I just feel absolutely blessed to do so and happy to build whatever. As long as I'm swinging a hammer, I'm happy. And I still do a lot of art, but it's all for me. It's more about me and my family and what is special to me. And that's really nice. I don't have to worry about trying to sell what I'm building in that way or follow art trends. That artwork is for me. And this is for whoever I'm working for. And in the end, money for my family.
For you, is it somehow not feeling like artwork when it's commissioned like that?
No. No, even building this shop felt like artwork.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've mentioned about different two-dimensional work that you do.
Mm-hmm.
How do those intersect for you, the 3D and 2D world?
Well, sketch-wise, if you can sketch it, you can build it. So that's really important, that two-dimensional work on that side. But a lot of the lines I draw, I've done a lot of abstract kind of wave forms, and I can see those translating really nicely into iron. It's just a matter of finding the time and the clients. And yeah, I just can't wait to get some of those forms into actual shapes and three-dimensional designs and things that you can physically interact with. And it's very exciting.
Do you work with patinas or color specifically at all in terms of changing the piece of iron to have a slightly different hue to it or tone?
Not so much yet. You know, most things are exterior, and so they got to withstand the weather, the moisture. So you can heat things up to get it that, you know, really pretty black, and then wire wheel to get some of the silver luster from underneath, and then wax it. And that's a great finish, but it doesn't last too long outside. So I've explored other things. I've done hot dip galvanizing and then painted. I've done powder coats. I mean, other people have done them for me. It's hard. It's hard to cover up something with paint that you've worked so hard on forging.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, and I love rust. The work I'm doing and the material I'm using, it's all solid material. You know, a lot of metal things that are built these days are hollow, either tubing or pipe, and that stuff needs to be coated. Now, if you're working with something solid, solid bar stock, and building it like it used to be built with these traditional techniques, the thing's going to last generations untouched. Most people have a problem with the rust when it rains, dripping and staining the concrete or the structure that it's on. Whatever this rust is going to touch, it's going to bleed and it's going to stain. But if you have it in a spot where you don't mind that or you don't mind that stain, I say just let it rust. It's got a wonderful texture. It's got a wonderful feel. I absolutely love the color. It's very warm and inviting to me, you know, and it gets hot, you touch it, it's alive. So I can't wait for that client who says, just let it rust.
To me, they're just often some gorgeous surfaces. And
with a story.
With a story.
But in the right place, it's a beautiful finish. Using the solid stock, the way you can punch holes and drift them open and have things pass through the other and get those wonderful shapes and forms intersecting in ways that you can't do welding and cutting. It's really, really neat to be able to let it rust and take on a life of its own. Punching a hole is similar to drilling a hole, where you're displacing the material instead of removing it. Start from one side, you drive the punch down, and you create a thin wafer at the bottom of the material. Then you flip it over, and you're able to shear that thin piece of material out. So you don't really lose anything. And you can do a slot punch, which is like a rectangle that is the same width as the diameter of the hole you want to end up with. And then a drift is basically looks like a round punch, but it's tapered on the nose, or the front of it's tapered to match that slot that you've punched. So you send the drift through, and it opens that hole up and pushes the material out. So if you have a bar, you can take a half-inch bar and punch and drift a half-inch hole. So you end up with these fabulous cheeks on the side. You know, the bar will swell out. You'll have your hole there. It's more dynamic than just drilling a hole through it. And that's something you can only do hot, and you can only do, you know, with these techniques that have been around for thousands of years. There is forge welding, which is getting two pieces hot enough and then using enough pressure to weld them together. So you can add metal together, but it's difficult. Basically, it's like clay that you can't touch. The same mass, the same amount that you start with is the same mass, the same amount you're going to end up with, only in a different shape.
So can we light up the forge?
Let's do it.
Yeah, all right.
Definitely. So I've got a gas forge. Propane gas forge as well. The gas forge is nice for the knives. It keeps things at a nice even temperature. A coal forge will get a lot hotter. You can make more specific heats, get a bar hot just in the right spot, right where you want it. But it gets really hot to the point where you can just melt your metal away completely. And that doesn't work so well when you're trying to forge out really thin, delicate knives. So I really like the gas forge for the knives and the open coal forge for everything else.
And what are you cleaning out here?
These are clinkers.
Well, I've heard that term before.
Yeah, these are all the impurities in the coal. You know, coal's pretty dirty. There's silica in there. There's phosphorus, sulfur. So all these things kind of gather together and create these rocks that kind of look like lava. And you got to keep them out of there because they just fall to the bottom. They clog your incoming air. Air coming in is really what gets the fire hot.
Crumpling up newspaper. So you're actually making kind of a ball.
kind of a ball. Yeah, I like to look at it, see it as a jellyfish. You know, we have this little piece that sticks out there, and that's where the light will start. So as you're working your fire, you start with coal, and you end up with coke. And coke is a more refined fuel. All that phosphorus and sulfur and stuff has been burnt off. It's pretty much pure carbon, and that's what is burning. If you were to take just raw coal and throw it onto your fire, it's just going to smoke. So you're slowly adding the coal closer and closer, and it's coking as it gets closer to that heat. What is actually burning is called coke.
Kind of nice to have the crank versus worrying about pumping a bellows forever, right?
Yeah. But this is a hand crank blower. As soon as you get it going, the arm, you know, will continue to turn, continue to send oxygen in there. And I really like using it over an electric blower.
So, more control?
More control, and it just sets up a nice kind of rhythm with the work. Once you get that blower going, the fire picks up, your metal gets hot, you stop, the fire dies down, you go to the anvil and work. Come back, same thing, get the fire going again, it picks up. So it just creates a nice rhythm. So the poker is real important. You can get in there and lift that fire up, get the oxygen in there. You can feel for clinkers. Uh-huh. You know, they make a real distinct sound, a clinking sound.
I'm sure that's where the name comes from. Is that where the name came from?
Keep your fire clean. It's going to burn hotter.
Your source of coal?
Farm Supply, Farrier's Coal. And I have made my own charcoal and use that, and that's really fun, really nice to burn. It burns real clean. It burns really fast. It sends a lot of sparks, kind of spits and hisses at you. So I usually wait till the rainy season to use that. It doesn't oxidize the metal as much as the coal will. Works really well for forging the knives.
I don't think I'm a pyromaniac, but playing with fires is somehow, there's something very satisfying about poking and getting something to kind of light up again. Or
definitely, it's in all of us.
You think so?
I think so. It's almost like I gotta hold myself back. Just leave the fire alone. Just let it do its thing. I don't want to keep poking it and touching it. Ah, just let it burn.
Okay, so now we've stuck a piece into the coals, getting the fire hotter. And so you're looking for a color?
I'm looking for a color. I slide the iron out real fast, take a look. We're going to go for a yellow heat right before it starts to spark. It's good to get it hot. I think that's one of the mistakes I made a lot as a beginner, was I didn't get it quite hot enough. And you just work twice as hard, get half as much done when you do that.
One of the things that I find it difficult to often help students understand is the rhythm that is about hammering.
Yeah, I agree. Finding that rhythm, everything goes so much smoother. It becomes meditation. It becomes a dance.
It's a hard thing to get across to people at first because they want to just pound.
Yeah, you want to just pound. And the sooner you can just work on your swing, but really getting the mechanics down and your rhythm down. You know, you're going to start slow, but it will pick up.
The other thing I'm learning about hammering is how the hammer is supposed to be doing the work and not our shoulder and elbow.
Exactly, and that's part of the mechanics. Basically dropping the hammer and guiding it to where it needs to be. You're not swinging it.
I've used that same terminology, that just think of almost letting it drop out of your hand but catching it first.
Try and use that bounce after it hits material to bring it back up, and then just basically letting it fall again.
So even though he's using a basic sledgehammer by using the edge of the anvil, it is kind of notching in the metal, and therefore the end is staying fatter and there's necked in, right?
Yeah.
Crude way of trying to describe that.
Yeah, they call this shouldering. So I got the material hanging off the side of the anvil. My hammer is half on and half off. So that edge of the anvil is making that indentation and kind of creating a head with a neck, basically, what we got going here.
Perfect. It's always fun to watch someone doing something that they make look so easy.
That's good to hear. So kind of resetting this taper and this shoulder here.
I'm going to go back to the ball. Probably two more heats to be able to get it nice and round, planish it down. It's definitely the transitions between forms that are the most challenging. You know, the transition from this taper to this ball. You know, that's the area that you're kind of paying most attention to and making sure you do right.
Right.
And the smell.
Yes.
It's a great smell.
I love the coal smell. I mean, maybe acquired for some, but yeah, I had an older gentleman come to my studio, and as soon as he walked up, you just on his face, you could see he was flashing back to his childhood. You know, you could just see it in his eyes. It's just that smell, that coal burning smell. My parents had a coal burning heater and furnace in the house he grew up in.
And common terminology, you were using the term planishing, which basically is very fine forging.
Yeah, you're basically manipulating just the surface of the metal.
Right.
Yeah, if you have the metal hot enough and you're swinging hard enough, you're moving things from within all the way to the exterior, you know, part of the metal. But the planishing is just kind of flattening down of the surface, if you will. And that starts happening as it cools more to a black heat. Just keep it moving. Need to come back to the top here. Straighten things out before I go back to the fire, just so I start with everything kind of straighter. Happy with it where everything is sitting, and I'm just kind of getting the surface to look the way I want. So yeah, I mean, I could keep going and get things
a lot tighter,
but the story's there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So have you got a website or other ways that people find you?
You know, right now I have an Instagram account, and it's hammerhead_forge. I do not have a web presence yet. I'm working on that. I finally now have enough images and things to build that website, but that's the next step.
Well, Dennis, this has been terrific. I can't thank you much on the QT for being willing to let me drop by and see what you're doing.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Thanks, Krissa.
You're most welcome.
Krissa Hewitt has been speaking with Los Osos artist and blacksmith Dennis Kehoe. Be sure to visit his Instagram account, hammerhead_forge. Be sure to check out the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art's website. Exhibits up during the month of April include works by Jenny Kendler, Doran Kazet, Virginia Harrison, and Nyla James. SLOMA.org. Also be sure to check out the Santa Barbara Museum of Art's website to view their current exhibits and their permanent collections. The museum is located at the corner of State Street and West Anapaumu in downtown Santa Barbara. The website is sbma.net. And for you San Luis Obispo artists, sign-ups for the Open Studios Art Tour are currently being accepted. The deadline for registration is April 24th, with a late fee application accepted through May 15th. Visit artsobispo.org for more information or call Program Director Lori Larian at 805-544-9251. You have been listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly interview program dedicated to the visual arts. Produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio that serves the California Central Coast from Ventura to Salinas. I am Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krissa Hewitt, we thank you so very much for listening and for supporting us over the years.